Why do we make mistakes? How many times have you berated yourself for what, looking back on it, was a really stupid mistake? What was I thinking? How could I do that? That was a really stupid mistake. A friend or a spouse or a passerby may try to make you feel better. You're only human. Everybody makes mistakes. Turns out there's a lot of truth in that. To err is human. Systematic error, not random, but systematic and predictable, is built into some of the ways we think. Systematic error is even built into how we see things. That's what this lecture is about, the ways that we as humans systematically go wrong and how we can correct for them. We don't have to be victims of our own systematic mistakes. If we are aware of cognitive biases, we can compensate for them. Let's start with some built-in biases. I have emphasized the power of visualization in a number of lectures. Because of our evolutionary heritage, people are particularly good at fast information processing in visual contexts. We've been exploiting that ability at every opportunity. We used it, for example, in using Venn diagrams and flow diagrams to convert abstract relations into something we can see. But our evolutionary heritage comes with certain built-in biases as well. There are perceptual heuristics built into the system that systematically mislead us. And that's what optical illusions are all about. A prime example is color vision. Look at squares A and B in this first image. Which is darker, patch A or patch B? Clearly A is. That's obvious. You can see that A is darker. But if we clip out those bits from the picture, move them over and put them side by side, things look entirely different. Patches A and B are, in fact, exactly the same shade of gray. Why is it that they look so different in the original picture? Here's the theory. In the context of that picture, square B is shown in shadow. Our perceptual system seems to compensate for that fact by making it appear lighter, as it takes its color to really be. It sees the shadow and compensates for the shadow by telling us that square B must really be lighter in color, and it tells us that by making B look lighter. We may think we see shades of color the way they are, but our perceptual system isn't built to see pure colors. It isn't built to detect the same wavelengths at different spots on a two-dimensional image. It's built to detect differences in a three-dimensional world, a world with real shadows. How long in our evolutionary history have we been dealing with three-dimensional contexts and real shadows? Millions of years. That's what the system was built for. How long have we been dealing with two-dimensional representations like the one you just saw? Not very long at all. It's only when we take bits of this two-dimensional picture out of that three-dimensional context and put them side by side that we see that our system has misled us as to the true wavelength of the patches in the picture. The same thing happens with color. We can put dots of orange in squares A and B. Dots of precisely the same wavelength. If we do, the one in the shadow will shine bright orange. The one out of shadow will look dull and darker. The heuristics built into our perceptual system were built for one kind of context, a three-dimensional world with real shadows. If you have to judge things in a different context, for example, if you're an artist judging color in a two-dimensional representation, you'll have to adjust for that built-in bias. We have similar built-in biases regarding judgments of length. Take a look at the tops of these two tables. Which one's narrower? Which one's closer to a square? Amazingly, the two shapes you see are precisely the same. Why don't they look the same? We're judging them as if we're viewing a three-dimensional scene. And in order for a three-dimensional scene to project those shapes onto your retina, you'd need a narrow table on the left and a fat square table on the right. Our perceptual system is made to detect the way things really are in the world, so it sees them that way. In a two-dimensional context, on the other hand, those shapes are exactly the same. The lesson? In a two-dimensional context, our perceptual system continues to carry a three-dimensional bias. If we're dealing with two-dimensional representations, we'll have to compensate for that. The table illusion persists even if we remove the clues of the legs. There's another surprising thing about these optical illusions. Even after we know the colors are the same, they still look different. Even after we know the two shapes are the same, they still look different. People often talk about how belief influences perception. They say that you see what you want to see, or that you see what you expect to see. And these optical illusions offer a counterexample. In cases like this, mere belief seems powerless in the face of our built-in perceptual biases. We know perfectly well that those two shapes are the same. We know perfectly well that those two shades are identical. But our built-in perceptual biases seem to ignore what we know. They still look different. Some of our mistakes are built into our information processing higher up. One source of error is attention bias. It's not true that we always see what we want to see, or what we expect to see, and it's a good thing that we don't. But it's sometimes true that we don't see what we don't expect to see, particularly if we're concentrating on something else. There's a one-minute video from a famous experiment on attention bias that shows two groups of people, some in black shirts, some in white shirts, interweaving in a small room as they pass basketballs to one another. If you were a subject participating in the experiment, you'd have been told to count the number of times the basketball is passed from one white team member to another. At about the 30-second mark in the video, a person in a gorilla costume enters the room. The gorilla pauses, thumps his chest, and leaves after about 5 seconds. All this time, the subjects have been trying to count the number of basketball passes. A few minutes later, they're asked, "Did you see anything unusual?" Amazingly, about half the experimental subjects failed to see the gorilla. They were concentrating on counting ball passes. They weren't expecting a gorilla, and so they didn't see it. Even when specifically asked, "Did you see anything unusual?" the answer was no. If you go online to watch the video, of course, you will see the gorilla. You'll be looking for it. You may find it hard to believe that anyone would miss the gorilla. But then again, you may have been one of the people who failed to notice that the color of my shirt and tie changed after you saw the gorilla. If so, you are a victim of what's called change blindness. There are people in the movie industry whose job it is to assure continuity between scenes, to make sure that Indiana Jones's hat doesn't change color between shots, for example. How many people will notice that kind of change? The answer is surprisingly few. The 1959 Hollywood classic Ben-Hur won 11 Academy Awards. The most famous scene is the chariot race with Charlton Heston. It lasts 11 minutes on screen, though I'm told it took months to film. But even that famous scene has continuity problems. The race starts with 9 chariots. 6 crash in the scene. That should leave 3. But if you watch it, you'll see that the race actually ends with 4. In videos constructed for psychological experiments, people often don't even notice that an actor has changed. That it's a completely different person carrying the action from one scene to the next. And it's not just changes on screen that we tend to notice. Daniel Simons and Daniel Levin, then at Cornell, performed an experiment in which a stranger asks a person for directions. During their conversation, two people carrying a door walk between them. But there's a twist. The experimenters had one of the door carriers change places with the stranger as the door went by. So the conversation begins with one person, a door goes by, the conversation ends with someone else. In that experiment, only 7 out of 15 people noticed the switch. Attention, then, comes with its own biases. We tend not to notice things that aren't at the focus of our attention, even when that thing is a gorilla. We're change blind. We often don't notice when things change. There are other gaps in our information processing. As you probably know, our memories are far from perfect. Just how imperfect? Here's an experiment for you. How many times have you seen a penny? Thousands. So tell me some things about pennies. Without looking, that would be cheating. Think of the side with Abe Lincoln in profile. Which way is he facing, right or left? You probably got that one. He's facing to the right. Now name 3 other things on that side of the penny. Take your time. Just dip into your memory banks. Give me 3 other features on that side of the penny. If you want to hit pause and think about it a minute, do so, but no cheating. Then come back. What are the other features on Abe's side of a penny? One of them's the date. Where is that? To the right of Lincoln or the left? It's to the right. You've got 2 features left. What are they? If you've got a really good memory, you'll remember that it says, "In God we trust," across the top. And the 4th feature? It's the one most people don't remember, even after handling pennies for their entire lives. The word liberty appears, just to the left of Lincoln's profile. Our memories are imperfect. They're also selective. Gamblers remember the times they won much more effectively than the times they lost. That's part of what keeps them gambling. There's another distressing aspect about memory. We think of our memories as photographs of real events filed away for future reference. But they are often less a function of the original photograph than of later representations. Our memories, however vivid, are often backward reconstructions from later reports. You may have a memory of some crazy thing you did when you were a kid. Remember that Thanksgiving that Pat snuck into the kitchen and ate the whole choke cherry pie by himself? Chances are, however vivid your memory, that what you remember is a reconstruction from the family stories of that event rather than the event itself. After I discussed this in one of my classes, one of my students went home for Thanksgiving and asked her family about a particularly vivid memory she had from her childhood. It turned out that the event she remembered so vividly as happening to her had in fact happened to her sister instead. The influence of verbal framing on memory has also been studied in the lab. Elizabeth Loftus is one of the world's foremost experts on eyewitness testimony. This is one of her classic studies. People were shown a film of a traffic accident and were then asked questions about it. Immediately after viewing the film, half the people were asked, about how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? The other half were asked, about how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? The only difference was how the question was phrased. About how fast were the cars going when they hit each other? About how fast were the cars going when they smashed into each other? 1 week later, the same people were asked a few more questions. Did you see any broken glass? There was, in fact, no broken glass in the accident. But if you had been asked about cars smashing into each other rather than hitting each other, you were twice as likely to say that there had been. The difference in a single word created different memories. I've performed eyewitness experiments several times in class. It's all staged, of course. Several graduate students come in the back of the class. One of them yells something. Another throws a water balloon. A third grabs my briefcase and ducks out a side door. All three of the perpetrators are wearing colored baseball caps. The whole thing takes about 15 seconds. Immediately afterwards, students are given questionnaires to fill out. But in fact, the questionnaires are different. Half of the students are asked, "What did the guy with the green baseball cap say?" The other half are asked, "What did the guy with the blue baseball cap say?" There was, in fact, no blue baseball cap. But when asked about the incident a week later, lots of the kids with the second question report seeing a blue baseball cap. They all saw the same incident, but what they remember may be a factor not of what happened, but of what they were asked later and how. The fact that memories are so easily manipulated by later questioning has some very serious consequences. Child abuse is a real problem, but so is the prospect of false memories of child abuse. Eyewitness testimony can be all too easily slanted by certain forms of police questioning. So no wonder we make so many mistakes. Our perceptual system is hardwired for some contexts and not others. Our information processing comes with attention bias. We're change blind. Our memories are malleable in terms of later questions and reports. If that weren't bad enough, it's also the case that some of our patterns of reasoning come mistake-prone. In the previous lecture, I talked about heuristics that make us smart, fast and frugal, intuitive rules of thumb that often seem to pay off. But there are also heuristics that make us dumb. Those are patterns that we use all the time and that don't pay off, habitual patterns of thought or perception that systematically mislead us. One's called an availability heuristic. So here's a simple test. Are there more English words that start with the letter K, or more English words that have the letter K in the third position? If you're like most people, you said there are more English words that start with the letter K. Why? It's easy to rattle off words that start with K. Kite, kangaroo, kindergarten, Kool-Aid. It's easy to think of words that start with a K. Those words are available, and we follow an availability heuristic. If it's easier to think of, we tend to think it's more common. But in fact, there are about three times as many English words that have a K in the third position. Bike, ask, acknowledge. It's a lot harder to think of words in terms of a third letter rather than a first letter, but that has nothing to do with how many there are. The availability heuristic misleads us. We take how easy it is to think of something to indicate how common or probable something is, and that's where we go wrong. In many cases, we tend to think in terms of simple and vivid images. That's fine if all we're interested in is a single case. The problem comes when we generalize from those single cases as if they were genuinely representative. Sometimes our vivid and available images come from media exposure. Images in the news are there because they're newsworthy. But when those become our vivid images, we tend to overestimate their probability. So which should you worry about more, airplane crashes or car crashes? Clearly the latter. There are many more car crashes than plane crashes, and many more people are injured or killed in car accidents. But airplane crashes tend to be big news. Car crashes don't. Because of that, people overestimate the relative risks of air travel. What's the chance of being murdered? What's the chance of dying from stomach cancer? Murder makes the news, and it's overestimated. It's about 5 times as likely that you'll die of stomach cancer. Shark attacks and death by lightning are vivid images. But they're not vivid because they're common, quite the opposite. When we reason about frequency or risk of events in terms of images alone, it's the availability heuristic that's the source of our mistakes. Just as images can mislead us, our starting points can. Those starting points are called anchors. Here it's an anchoring and adjustment heuristic that can mislead. The starting point, the anchor, can come from lots of places. It can come from something as simple as how a question is phrased. In talking about mistakes of memory, we mentioned the fact that memory can be influenced by how a question is phrased. It turns out the same holds for rational calculation. What percentage of African nations do you think are members of the United Nations? Is it more than 10%? Give me a figure. What do you think the percentage really is? People who were asked the question that way tended to give answers averaging about 25%. Other people were asked the question this way. What percentage of African nations do you think are members of the United Nations? Is it more than 65%? Give me a figure. What do you think the percentage really is? In that case, the average answer was 45%. Why? The theory is that the figure given in the question is taken as an anchor. Is it more than 10%? Yeah, it must be more than that. So you adjust up from that anchor. You end up in the 25% range, perhaps. Is it more than 65%? No, that seems a lot. People use 65% as the anchor and they adjust down. They end up in the 45% range. But of course, the real probabilities have nothing to do with how the question is asked. Something like 93% of African states are members of the United Nations. The anchor and adjustment heuristic has led us astray. Then there's this rationality problem. We all think we're better than average. Garrison Keillor classically began his stories with, "Welcome to Lake Wobegon, where all the women are strong, all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average." It's a joke, of course. It can't be true that all the children are above average. And yet, when people are asked about their driving skill, almost everyone rates themselves as above average. When asked about how attractive they are, almost everyone rates themselves above average. We also tend to be overconfident in our own abilities. We tend to be overconfident in our ability to stick to a diet, for example, or to keep with the gym plan. We tend to be overconfident in our ability to make money in the stock market or to win at the casino. Even there, we think we'll do better than average. It's become known as the Lake Wobegon effect. According to Stefano Della Vigna, an economist at UC Berkeley, overconfidence is a general feature of human psychology. Almost everyone is overconfident. The only exception, he says, are people who are depressed. They're the ones who tend to be realists. That makes me think twice about whether overconfidence should be considered an intellectual vice after all. If the alternative is depression, we may be better off thinking of ourselves as above average. With confidence, even overconfidence, comes a life of exploring new options, trying new things, dreaming big. That sounds better to me. Maybe realism is overrated. The take-home message? Some of the sources of mistakes we've said are built in. All we can do about those is know that they're there and compensate for them. Don't assume that the color things look is the way they really are. Some sources of mistakes are built into our information processing. Be aware that attention bias may blind you to other things going on. Don't bet on your ability to notice all changes around you. We all tend to be change blind. And don't treat your memory as photo perfect in all cases. What you remember is malleable to suggestion and later representation. Some of our mistakes stem from unreliable heuristics. Some of those we can deliberately avoid. We can see them coming and steer clear. In order to avoid the availability heuristic, think beyond a single image. Anchor and adjustment, be suspicious of that anchor wherever it comes from. Better than average, be aware that your estimates tend in that direction and compensate for them when necessary. In another lecture, an earlier lecture, we talked about simple heuristics that make us smart. So, are heuristics good or bad? Both. What we need to do is to use the good ones and avoid the bad ones. Even better, be aware of the heuristic you're using and pay attention to both how it might help and how it might lead you astray. Heuristics are rules of thumb for patterns of thought. I talked earlier about von Neumann's deliberate attempt to stock his mind with potentially useful technical formulae. But you don't have to be von Neumann, and the conceptual patterns don't have to be technical. Collecting patterns of thought across cultures can do the same thing. even if the patterns are as simple as fairy tales. Let me give you a puzzle. A treasure hunter is going to explore a cave on a hill near a beach. He suspected there might be many paths inside the cave and was afraid he might get lost. Obviously, he didn't have a map of the cave. All he had with him were some common items, such as a flashlight and a bag. What could he do to make sure he didn't get lost when trying to get back out of the cave? If you want to take a minute to think about it, press pause and come back. What could he do to make sure he didn't get lost in the cave? He could take a bag full of sand from the beach and sprinkle it along his path. When that puzzle was given to American college students, about 75% gave that solution. But when the puzzle was given to Chinese students, only 25% solved it. Why? The theory is that American students had a heuristic. They had a template of how to solve this kind of story. They had the story of Hansel and Gretel. Now let me give you another puzzle. Let's see if you get the answer to this one. In a village by a river, the chief of the region took care of its sacred stone statue. It was the chief's custom every year to go downriver to the next village to collect taxes. To assess the amount of taxes, the chief would ask for the statue's weight in gold coins. His method of measuring this amount was to put the statue in a large tub at one end of a hanging balance scale, hook the other end of the scale to another large tub. This second tub was filled with gold coins until the scale balanced the weight of the statue. During one trip to collect taxes, the chief forgot to bring his balance scale. Now he had a problem. How could he figure out how much gold to take to match the statue's weight without the benefit of a balance scale, a pulley system, or a conventional scale? If you want, take a minute to think about that one too. That one's not so easy, right? Only 25% of American college students got a solution to that one. But 75% of Chinese college students did. That's because they had a different heuristic from a different folktale. I'll finish with the folktale of Chao Chang. Chinese students had grown up with this story, with this template, much as American students had grown up with Hansel and Gretel. Long ago in China, there lived a powerful emperor. Every year, the rulers of the surrounding countries had to give him jewelry, gold, cloth materials, and animals as presents. One day, a ruler of a southern country presented him with an elephant as a gift. The emperor was delighted to see the elephant and asked the ruler what the weight of the elephant was. The ruler was embarrassed because even the biggest scale he owned was too small to weigh the huge elephant. The emperor's youngest son, named Chao Chang, came up with an idea. You could find a boat, put the elephant in it, and mark the new water level on the boat. Then you could take the elephant out of the boat and put smaller stones into the boat until the water level reaches the same mark. Then you could weigh those stones separately with a small scale. When you add up all the weights, you'd know how heavy the elephant is. By crossing cultures, you now have two heuristics, two templates, Hansel and Gretel and the story of Chao Chang. In the next lecture, I want to talk about rationality in social interaction, in particular, how to be rational in a polarized context.